Tonight we're speaking with John Zazula, better known as Johnny Z. Johnny Z is widely known in the heavy metal scene for discovering the band Metallica, along with many other early 80s bands, and going on to found the label Megaforce Records. In addition to Metallica, he has managed and released albums by Anthrax, Testament, Merciful Fate, Raven, Overkill, Exciter, Stormtroopers of Death, or probably better known as SOD, Ace Frehley of Kiss, King's X, and Ministry, just to name a few. He's talking to us today to promote his autobiography, which I believe comes out next week, which is Heavy Tales, The Metal, The Music, The Madness, as Lived by John Zazula. I'm in Newcastle, New South Wales, Australia, and he's in Orlando, Florida, USA. It's 9 at night for me, and it's 6 in the morning for him over there. So how are you this morning, Johnny?
Fine. I'm up. I'm ready to roll.
Excellent. Well, look, you do have a new book coming out. That is what we're here to talk about. I mean, the story of how you actually got involved in an autobiography of sort of being a background interviewee to a larger Metallica book is interesting in and of itself. But before we get into any of that stuff, why don't you know, you founded Megaforce Records, and a lot of people are going to know a lot about this. But before we get into that, tell us, give us an introduction of your life prior, before entering into the heavy metal scene.
Well, what people have to understand is that I never wanted to be in this scene. I never looked to be in the scene. Everything pretty much happened by magic. If you read the book, you'll see that I lived on the streets as a youth because of the home I grew up in. And I went to school every day while I was out on the street and managed to get myself onto Wall Street, where I got involved with the wrong crowd and ended up doing some time. And basically, while incarcerated, to make enough money to support my family, I started a music store. I was a big music lover all my life. I loved music from the day years old. I was introduced to it through my parents, who loved music. But what happened was, with that knowledge of music, I opened up a little flea market booth to make $70 a weekend, which at that time was enough to feed my family. And what happened was, we earned that $70 through a miracle, because at first we thought it wasn't even going to earn that. You could read this in the book. It's really good the way it's spelled. I'm not saying because I wrote it. It's a good story. And from the flea market, I built a business of a big, giant, heavy metal record store that people came from 500 miles just to see what was happening. We had everything. I mean, from Japan, from France, from America, from England. We had it all. Germany. And it was at this record store that somebody came to us with a cassette tape, a demo of a band called Metallica. And that demo tape made me run to a phone booth and call a name on the tape, which was KJ Dorton. And KJ Dorton put me in touch with Lars Ulrich. And believe it or not, not knowing what I was even going to do with the band, I ended up speaking to Lars. I was promoting 12 shows in the area at the time. So I had Lars and the boys, I invited them to come and play the shows. Once they got here, we got involved with each other on a business level, and the rest is history. How's that?
That's good. I want to get into that, because this stuff is fascinating, of a different period in time. I mean, so around this time, you're based in New York, so city and state?
I was New Jersey.
Jersey boy, okay. So take me through this. I mean, this is fascinating in and of itself, that you go from Wall Street to jail to becoming one of the founders of the early thrash metal movement. How do you get a job on Wall Street, and who are these people that you get mixed up with?
Well, I went and got my license to trade stocks. I went to school for that. That's one of the things I did. And at the time I went, I was working on Wall Street. Gold was going crazy. If we remember when gold went nuts.
In 81, 82, I was 1 year old.
Well, in 81, 82, gold went bananas. And I saw these young fellas without college educations making as much as $17,000 a week.
Right.
And here I am making maybe $500 a week saying, hey, man, I want to make that kind of money. But unfortunately, I got involved with this group of people at the end of the gold run, and there was nothing else to do. So they got involved in what was called strategic minerals, where people would invest in materials that were used supposedly in the arms race that America was stockpiling, and they were going up in value. I figured that was a good, safe investment, very smart, except what we were selling, we didn't know, was not 100% pure. And on one day, as I returned to office to the office on a Monday, the federal government was there with all their marshals, and they had all the phones pulled out of the walls, and they had us all arrested. We didn't even know what we were arrested for until they explained it to us. But we had no chance of winning in court because they had us on a conspiracy theory. And the attorney general in the area really wanted to make an example of us. So I pled guilty and ended up doing time in a halfway house, which is halfway between prison and outside. But you got to sleep there at night amongst the criminals. And most of the people there were people who just got out of prison and were waiting for the transition to go home. And that's where I was for four and a half months. I was supposed to be there for six. But they really felt bad for me, the marshal. And he wrote up a report that I was a good guy. And they let me out early. And he saw how hard I was working because I was promoting shows while I was in the halfway house.
Really?
Yeah. I had to use the payphone. There was one payphone. They didn't have digital phones then. Just one phone on a wall where you put change in, where everybody was standing online to call their sweethearts because they just got out of prison.
Yeah.
And I'm standing online talking about Anthrax shows, not Anthrax shows then, but Venom shows, Metallica shows. Yeah. And I called Metallica, was the code name for Metallica was Cool in the Gang.
Okay.
So they thought I was doing a Cool in the Gang show for the group there, while meanwhile I was promoting shows on the outside.
So why do you have to use the code word Cool in the Gang to promote an unknown band from the Bay Area?
It was easier to explain, and it was sort of like somebody that they thought they could relate to as a band that was coming to entertain them, and that would be cool.
Gotcha. Okay. What was it like sort of in a halfway house? I mean, does that mean you've got freedom of movement during the day, and you effectively have to come back to camp or prison just to stay the night?
It meant that I lost my driver's license. It meant that I lost my securities exchange license. And I had to work a job, any job I could find, from 9 to 5, and then sleep in the halfway house from 6 o'clock on. Now, because I didn't have a driver's license, Marsha with baby had to drive all the way to me, an hour, pick me up, take me to work, drive home, come get me after work, drive me back to the halfway house. It was a very big hardship for her.
So, where did you always have the love of the music? Because you said you didn't intend to get into this, but it sounds by the time that you were convicted in the halfway house, you're already producing or promoting shows. So tell me about your journey into, through tape trading, how you get involved in this and promoting shows.
I always tell people I was never a tape trader.
Okay.
What happened when I had the music store, the record store, I was a tape absorber. Just everybody would bring me their tapes. They wanted it to be heard at the store. They wanted me to sell it at the store. So basically all the tapes worked their way to me, but I didn't trade. I represented bands. And I got into the store, as I said earlier, because I needed $70 a week to pay my grocery bill. That was our budget. And I collected records all my life. So I would bring in my rarities and sell them to people at the flea market. And then eventually, Marsha and I bought records from an importer that were rare to begin with. And we would sell them at the flea market, mostly picture discs. You know, those 45s or albums where the picture is pressed into the vinyl?
Yeah.
Well, we specialized in that. And that's how we made our money, paid the $70. I was always a music lover. I always knew what music was good, bad, or whatever. And it seemed like my taste worked out with the taste of the consumer. And it worked all the way to the very end. It was a very successful business.
Okay, great. Look, what we were talking about is, you know, between the halfway house and where you were, we were talking about how you sort of got involved in this. And you were saying that you hadn't really intended to get into this. So where we had left this off was saying, like, you know, at what point in time did you get into promoting shows? Was this before your Wall Street career, during that time, or once you had gone off to jail?
No. Everything happened at Rock and Roll Heaven, the flea market.
Okay.
And what happened was one of our good customers walked into the store by the name of Rockin' Ray. And he said to me, "Johnny, could you bring any of the bands here? It would be great if we could see some of these bands in these magazines, like Anvil."
Yeah.
So I said, "That's a great idea. Let's do a show." I had no idea what it was like to do a show. I just said, "Let's do it." That's just the way I am.
Okay.
And I called up who I had to call up to find Anvil, which wasn't easy.
Yeah.
I ended up talking to Al Mayer, who owned Attic Records in Canada, in Toronto, I believe. And he put me in touch with the band, and I made my deal with the band. And next thing you know, Anvil played a show for me in New Jersey to all my customers of the record store. We had about 800 people show up. So basically, we brought Anvil to the United States and had a great, great show. And from there, it gave me the idea to maybe do another one.
Yeah.
And the show we did were some local shows in the area with Anvil. And then I brought Raven to America. And we did a bunch of shows in the area. And then we put everybody together, Raven, Anvil, and a band called Riot, together for a show at the St. Oh, my God. I forgot the name of the theater. But we played a show in Staten Island to about 1,500 people called the Halloween Headbanger Ball,
okay,
which was another big success. And from there, we brought Venom to America. And to open up for Venom, we had Metallica open.
Yes.
So that was their first shows in America, in the Northeast, opening up for Venom.
Did you ever see the Anvil documentary that came out, what, maybe 5 or 10 years ago now?
Yes.
Well, what did you think of that? Because it's always interesting to me, as I said, I'm originally Canadian, so they seem to have you know, sort of fallen off the map in comparison to a lot of other sort of thrash heroes. You know, what was your dealings with them like, and what did you think of the film itself?
I thought the film was very good.
Yeah.
And it did depict Anvil, you know, as to where they were and why they never made it. And they just keep on slugging and slugging. You know, every band has a silver lining or they don't. I found that stars shine on bands or they don't.
Mm.
You could be the band in the world, but if the success card doesn't shine on you, there's nothing you can do about it. I don't think it's Anvil's fault. I don't think it's Raven's fault. These are great bands, but they never made it to superstar status. But it doesn't take away the fact that they're great bands and they give a great show every night. They just didn't tap it.
What do you think it is? Do you think it's about a band coming around at a particular time? Is it more about their, because at that point in time, comparatively today, most people listen to music through their computer, but back then it would have been, you know, much more about experiencing the live show. Do you think there's any factors in what is able to make or break a band?
Well, I must say, when you speak about Anvil or you speak about Raven, you got great live shows. It was the metal god. I believe that. You may say I'm foolish.
Yeah.
But I know that all the king's horses and all the king's men can't make happen what can't happen.
Can you help me understand a little bit more about what was going on around that time? So you started this shop. In the year that we're talking about, Metallica's really new because they bring on thrash. So prior to that, we're talking about bands like Iron Maiden, Motorhead, Judas Priest, and there's a gigantic bridge between those bands to Metallica. And I did an interview a few months ago with Brian Slagle of Metal Blade, and he was talking about the importance that punk played in this role. Were you a fan of all these genres when you decided to open the shop, or were you just a music fan in general, or were you more of a rock guy back then?
Well, I liked hard, aggressive music. I was a big fan of Motorhead. I liked Iron Maiden a lot. And Angel were one of my favorite bands at the time. And when Rock Until You Drop came out from England, you know, it brought me closer to the new wave of British heavy metal. And I felt that the new wave of British heavy metal set the path for what was hopefully going to happen in America, some kind of revolution that sounded like that. And until there was a Metallica, I didn't hear anything that sounded like that.
Mm. So there wasn't anything coming out on the East Coast, or even because Metallica came up around the same time as you know, Slayer. Megadeth obviously came out because of Mustaine, but you're saying that really Metallica was really the first band to sort of produce that level of aggression in their music?
Yes. They were for me. I mean, Motorhead had that kind of intensity. And I thought that Metallica were America's answer to Motorhead.
Mm. And so again, how did this, someone just simply brought this in to your attention? You said, I need to do something with this effectively?
Well, what happened was people would come to me and always try to turn me on to music too, if they thought I would love it.
Mm-hmm.
But they brought me a demo, and I don't play demos in my store unless I went home and heard it. Now I want people to hear it because it was approved. I didn't want to test it with the public walking through my store saying, what the hell is that? But the fellow convinced me to put it on that moment. He said, John, you're really going to love this. I got to take it with me. You got to listen to this tape. And I just did. And when it blew my mind from here to China.
There's a lot of discussion sort of when heavy metal came around. I mean, you know, you're a little bit older than me. I'm almost 40, but there's a lot of kids that will probably listen to this that are anywhere between the ages of like 15 to 25 that are really still discovering the music. When you talk about heavy metal, some people consider this as early as stuff like, you know, Thin Lizzy through to T-Rex, through to Priest and Maiden. Heavy metal to me is more about these, you know, the big four thrash bands that came up. A lot of people say it's really Sabbath who put the hammer down. What do you sort of remember of that time frame of when there was rock bands, then there was really heavy metal, and this invasion of new wave of British heavy metal?
Well, first of all, metal was sporadic. It wasn't really heavy metal. It was called heavy music. When Cream first came out, they were much, much heavier than what you saw in the revival of Cream. They were very heavy. That was the heaviest thing that I ever saw. And then I heard the sound again with the Jeff Beck group later on. And then Led Zeppelin were pretty heavy. You know, that's the was the beginning of heaviness. But it wasn't until really Iron Maiden and Motorhead and the British scene that I felt that metal was really then a genre to be contended with. You know, the early Scorpions, UFO, you know, heavy stuff.
Yeah. And back then, you know, because this stuff would have come in. So if we're talking Maiden, Motorhead, we're talking sort of, you know, the later 70s. And then around, what, 79 or about then, we get the Sex Pistols and that first really aggressive version of punk. What I'm asking you with this is these days, you know, as you'd probably know, there's a lot of people that listen to black metal who don't associate with people who listen to death metal, who don't associate with people who listen to, you know, progressive music. Were the early metalheads into the punk and were punk into metal? And was there a lot of, you know, we've got hardcore crossover that happened in the 80s, but when we talk sort of about 5 years before then, were people more open-minded to this?
It wasn't much of a crossover in my world.
Okay.
You know, you had your punk, you had your hard music, you know, you had your rockers. It was all segregated. I didn't find the uniform music, believe it or not. Even Metallica is not punk to me. They have a real punk attitude. I'll tell you that. The players did. But it wasn't punk music to me.
Okay. Now, you had said that you weren't a tape trader, but again, for people that are younger, they really have no idea of how this was the underground market before, you know, 20 years before the internet. Can you just tell us about a little bit of your experience of getting hold of new bands? You know, when there wasn't an MTV and there wasn't a magazine that you can just go out and buy, and there's obviously not the internet. Can you talk a little bit about the importance or what you remember of tape trading and fanzines from that period in time?
Well, fanzines had a lot to do with the movement. And fanzines talked about the metal that was bubbling under, that was getting ready to come. Or who are heroes in Europe already that just didn't break over here. Tape trading was a big deal too, but people were trading tape. Again, I was a tape trader. I keep on saying that. They just kept on coming to me. I didn't send them out. If you wanted a tape of a band, you could buy it at my store. People gave me their tapes to be sold at Rock and Roll Heaven. And I selected the ones I thought that were really good. For instance, I liked Overkill a lot. So Overkill was a big tape at my store.
Okay. So, look, I mean, the people are listening to this and saying, oh, this is the guy who discovered Metallica. So, as you said, a mate of yours gets you to play it in the store. You get on the phone and you end up contacting Lars and you encourage them to come over. Tell us about how you set up that first tour with them and how you developed the relationship with them and ultimately end up forming a record label out of this.
Well, we had originally 12 shows for them to play. What I didn't know was that I didn't realize there was no place for them to stay. There was no place for them to hang out, so they had to live in my house. Now, at that time, I also had Venom living at my house. I had Anvil in and out of my house. I had Raven living in my house. My house was a crazy place. And I basically told them that what I was doing and what I was trying to build in metal, and everybody gravitated towards me. And what eventually happened was I got more and more and more shows for them to play. And the scene just started to grow. It got very big, very fast. It started with 50 people, by the way, Jess. But Anvil, you know, I was able to pull about 800. Then I had four, which did numbers. And then all of a sudden, Metallica were doing a few hundred people, too, by themselves. I had them open up for Twisted Sister. That was amazing. You know, there was a lot of good shows.
So what happens from there? You know, you get them over. So again, people probably won't even understand it. Like, what are the costs back then? You know, this is 30, 80, 90, 10, four, almost 40 years ago. What does it cost to put a band on a plane back then and bring them over for a tour when there's sort of no guarantees? And, you know, these kids are probably about, what, 19 at that point in time?
Let me tell you something. It was a very, very heavy risk. Very heavy risk. I lost a lot of money on Venom. Venom did not draw what we had expected. And in America, I played them on a Super Bowl Sunday with Metallica. You don't do that. Mm. So it was very costly. I lost my shirt a few times, but I didn't have a shirt to lose. You have to realize I was a very poor man. Mm-hmm. I did this just like a fan who loved music and just said, I'm going to bring these bands over. I had no backing, no finance. I went to clubs and I sold shows that would pay for it. And the clubs took a chance on the bands. And I would have one big pivotal show in the area. And that's how we did it.
So at which point you bring them over during the tour, do you decide that you want to create a label and make these guys like the signing? How does that evolve into what Megaforce becomes?
It happened with Metallica. I tried to sign to many record companies. I was able to get appointments, but they didn't know what the hell they were listening to. They thought it was They literally ducked under the tables. They just didn't know what to say. Okay. And I got to the point where I am with a band that wants to do an album. I felt this could be the greatest album ever if somebody would put it out. So I put my first foot forward. And I said to Marsha, we're going to start a record company. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice.
No, you're right.
And we started a company originally. We were going to call it Vigilante Records because we're doing it ourselves. But I was down on Times Square in New York, and I saw Vigilante was playing with another movie. There was a movie called Vigilante.
Okay.
And playing with Megaforce.
Right.
And I said, this is the greatest name for a record company, Megaforce. And we named it Megaforce Records. And we started up the company just to put out the Metallica record with no money, no nothing, just a will to succeed.
Okay. So we're going to talk about their debut with Megaforce. But at the time, the demo that you got, I believe, was No Life Till Leather. Was that... Was that Ron McGovney doing bass on that, or was that still Burton at that point in time? Do you remember?
Burton
was on there. Okay, great. So now the big question, you decide that you're going to start a label out of this. Tell me about that process of deciding to go into business doing this, and what's involved in, well, first of all, creating a business, then signing a band, then going into a studio, then printing a record, then trying to figure out how to sell and distribute it.
You just said the whole thing. There was no book. There was no way to go for the answers. I just did it.
So how do you arrange this initially? Because, you know, record deals are pretty complicated, these things these days, where there's, you know, there's money up front with an expectation of selling this and a tour. How do you originally, you know, shake hands and do a deal with them?
Well, basically, we had a contract. And I put out every cent I had and didn't have. And I promised that I would put out X amount of records, just like a record company. I took it very seriously. And I ran it like a record company. And the success we had was based on a lot of work. Remember, there was no internet, no cell phones, no Facebook. No social media, no nothing. If you wanted to break a band, you had to do it locally. You had to do it with big, giant ads in magazines that don't even play your kind of music. You had to do it in full-page ads in your entertainment weekly local rags that went out in the area. And where people would advertise quarter pages or little lines, just blurbs about their band, I would advertise full pages, and people would say, what the fuck is this?
Right. Okay.
And I made it look like the circus was coming to town. And people were interested, and they came. And the band was bigger than the hype. They were better than my hype.
And tell me about the reaction then, because again, this is the part that I find fascinating about it, because you've talked about how there wasn't really anything like this before. So this is new. There's got to be some people, because, you know, I mean, if you're listening to, I think Def Leppard comes a little bit later, but if you're into Twisted Sister and that more glam stuff, this can seem pretty extreme. So what was the overall reaction, you know, when you get on to distributing this and promoting it initially?
Well, you know what? I had to play in front of those other audiences and win the people over. Find out who was liking it and who would stick to it. You know, it's like playing with a Twisted Sister audience. Nobody expects a Metallica. Mm. But if you walk out of there with 50 fans, that's 50 more that will show up at the Metallica headline show.
And so Megaforce now has one artist that you're promoting. Tell me about the journey out of this, of how you grow it into like a fully fledged label with more acts. At this point in time, it's really just Metallica. So tell us about that story.
It's a very long story, and that's the reason for the book. I will tell you this, that Anthrax came to us in the store. They wanted to be on Megaforce Records with Metallica. They wanted to be part of the Johnny Z scene. The live shows in the area, the excitement of what was going on with the metal. You could smell it in the air. It was a revolution. And then came Overkill. And then came Manowar. And then the label started to develop and sell a shitload of records. And then Roadrunner Records started in Holland. And they asked me to break a band called Merciful Fate in America.
Yes.
So now you have Venom, Raven, Metallica, Manowar, you know, Anthrax. All these bands, all of a sudden you're building a scene. Mm-hmm. And everybody says if it comes out on Megaforce, it's got to be good.
Back then, are you involved? Are you involved with all the touring of these artists? Because I know eventually, I think as you step away from Megaforce, you focus on touring. But when you were just a record company, were you involved in the touring and merchandising as well?
Yes, my hands were in everything. Touring, album covers, lyrics, music. I didn't write the lyrics. I didn't write the music. I didn't play on the stage. But the whole planning of everything was done by me and the group. And Marcia.
Mm. Your wife is a very important part of your life. And I know that when this the autobiography is coming out, you talk about it's not really about me. It's our life together. Do you want to talk about your relationship with her and how you've, you know, built this together? Because it sounds like you're very much in partnership with her on this.
Well, you have to realize that I started without any money. My mortgage was 6 months late. My electric got turned off every month. Yet the bands were in the studios playing live shows and growing every day. I had a wife that put up with that. Not only did she put up with it, but she was part of the creative process as well and had a lot to add to what I was doing. And she had a lot of ideas. And she told me when I was doing things a little bit wrong.
Okay.
And so she was like a mentor, partner, wife, and good buddy. A real good buddy.
Very good.
And 40 years now, and we're partners for 30.
You mentioned a few labels. You know, you said Roadrunner. I remember I've still got a few cassettes. I've got a few Megaforce prints. I even have some Road Racer records before they became Roadrunner out here and signed on. And as I mentioned a few months ago, we had the chance to speak with Brian Slagle from Metal Blade Records, and your name actually came up during that interview. What do you remember about these labels and some of the other personalities that were running the labels and the scene back then?
Well, what was to make Megaforce different was that we took the bands into the studio and we recorded really fine on the album, where the other labels were pretty much putting out demos and just putting them on vinyl. So right away, Megaforce had a quality of sound and a quality of album covers that nobody else had, which separated us from the rest. Other labels have gone on to become big now. But at the time of Megaforce, we ruled the coup big time.
All right. Look, let's talk about some of the nitty-gritty stuff. There's a whole bunch of things that come up about, you know, Metallica's pretty infamous from their past days, including, you know, older fans will remember them being referred to as Alcoholica, I think, before maybe Pantera ended up taking that title from them. Notorious drinkers, and down here in Australia specifically, Metallica was supposed to do a big tour, and James Hetfield has relapsed again with his substance abuse. What do you remember about their days as this hard drinking band back then?
Well, they were really a hard drinking band back then. You know, the first thing they did when they got to me was attack my bar. And they poured glasses, they took the bottle, you know, and they just took the bottle. What can I say? That came with the personality of the spirit that it took to compose that kind of music and thrash the way they did. Mm. You know, nothing phony about them. You know, they were partying, young, crazy kids.
Now, as part of that, there's always, anyone who sort of grew up in this period, there was always a debate about whether you were a Metallica or a Megadeth sort of guy. And I ended up getting pretty heavy into Megadeth. And you would have been around that scene where they gave Dave Mustaine the boot. Again, because of alcohol and drugs and substance abuse. Do you remember anything through that time of when they decided that he was no longer, you know, the infamous story is that apparently he woke up one morning and they said, you're out of the band, and gave him a bus ticket out of town. What was sort of your experience with that? Because, you know, he ends up playing with Kerry King in the early days of Megadeth and then goes on to found pretty much a band that's simply there to try to fight Metallica on that scene.
I don't know if they fought Metallica on that scene. I don't know if that was really the scene. You know, Megadeth were Megadeth, Metallica were Metallica. You know, Dave Mustaine at one time was a part of Metallica. You know, I was there for everything that happened. I saw it all happen. And, you know, the truth is that it happened for a reason and a good reason. I'm happy that Dave has gone on to Megadeth and he has done what he has done. I wish him the very best. I always did. You know, let everybody live and be well is the way I live. And you had two bands. I never felt the fire between Megadeth and Metallica. I always felt Dave was out to prove his point and did. And I felt Metallica were out to prove their point and did.
Okay. So Metallica obviously begins encountering a lot of success at this point in time. And for, you know, most of us around my age, we remember them being signed to Elektra for, I don't know, what feels like maybe 10 of their album deals, who I believe, if I'm not mistaken, ends up signing them after they do the Kill 'Em All album. There are some interesting things that go on, I think, that you talk about in the book about some, you know, the sadness and depression that comes out of this. Can you tell me a little bit what's going on about that time where they opt not to do the next record with you, and what ends up happening with Elektra?
Well, they never said they weren't going to do the next album with me. They did Ride the Lightning.
Okay.
What happened was I was trying to sign them to Elektra. I was trying to sign them to a lot of record labels. The problem is that the Elektra deal was concluded without me and with other managers. Mm. And you have to realize that Metallica were with me. I was always trying to get money to support them because I wasn't financed well. I didn't have the business savvy to really maintain them at a level that they needed to be maintained. It was always a struggle. And you know where they say the grass is always greener?
Yeah.
On the other side? Well, they made a move. And it was a business move. I was very depressed. My whole life was involved with them. I was very hurt. Left me. But that's just the way business is. Mm. You know? to live with it and deal with it a lot better in the time that passed. But it hurt a lot when it first happened.
For mental health is becoming a much less of a taboo subject these days. But there's a lot of people who say that they suffer from depression and issues like bipolar, which is mentioned some of the things that you've had to deal with in your life. As an outsider looking in, as someone who you've said suffers from this, you know, we don't understand what this is like. Can you just give us an insight into what that was like to deal with? And I guess just try to explain broadly what that's like to deal with people like myself who have never encountered that as an issue.
Imagine just obsessively thinking about negative things that are so negative that it puts you into a hole where you just can't get up out of bed, or you just don't want to deal with the world, or you have too much anxiety to drive a car. It's just that world. It's very dark, and it's very not fun.
How do you end up dealing with that? Because you create success out of this despite these issues. So how do you manage this?
Well, it's called manic depressiveness also. That was the old name, being manic depressive. A manic depressive has the manic, which is the storm of achieving and feeling, just feeling great from achieving. As depressed as you could be on the dark side is how great you could feel on the positive side. And I never gave myself a chance to be depressed. I just kept on working and working and working my fingers on the phone, never giving my mind time to think about anything dark, just thinking about what it could achieve. That's all well and good, but when it catches up to you, you're in for a major fall. And I've had a few falls in my history. I hope this makes sense to you.
But, it does, but it's always different as an outsider looking in because, you know, these are sort of black holes that people don't have to deal with. And the common idea is just sort of, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and get on with it.
Yes, that's very easy to say. But imagine being sick with it. Imagine being sick with it. That, remember, some people take drugs to not feel that way. Some people drink themselves to death. You know, I tried to live my life and run a family and three children and make sure everything in business and family ran well. So I had to stay somehow centered through this whole thing. But it isn't something you could just, you know, pick yourself up and go. It's a sickness.
Okay. I think the reason why I got onto this is that you had mentioned that you got really depressed when Metallica moved on to a new label. What, after Metallica signed a bigger deal and moved on from Megaforce, I believe that you guys are reconciled on good terms now, but did anything happen to that relationship at that point in time?
Well, it wasn't good. We didn't speak to each other like years. It all came together, finally, unfortunately, right before Cliff died, when Anthrax went on tour with Metallica in Europe. We were together and had to deal with each other, basically. But now things couldn't be better. We've all grown up, you know?
And was there a moment when the air was cleared, or was it just the fact that some time and separation allowed you guys to come back together?
I think we both appreciate where we are in each other's history now. They give me credit, I did, and I understand what they did.
You were around the period when some, you know, you had already mentioned Cliff Burton. Another name that comes to mind is Randy Rhoads. I've mentioned publicly a number of times I'm a big fan of the Pantera brothers and the band itself. You've been around for a lot of the passings of a lot of the iconic people of the scenes. What do you remember about them, their passing, and some of the celebrations of their life?
Well, I could talk to you about Randy Rhoads. When Randy passed away down in Florida, he actually passed away 15 minutes from where I live. The Rock and Roll Heaven, the record store, was like a church. People came from everywhere to come and mourn and be together and just reflect on Randy Rhoads' life. It was a very somber time in the history of Rock and Roll Heaven.
Did you have any, did you know him personally through tours, or what was
No, I never knew Randy. I lived, how can I explain it to you? I'm not that kind of guy. I didn't hang out with Ozzy. I may have went on tour with Ozzy with Anthrax for 3 months, but that doesn't mean that I hung out with Ozzy at all. Do you follow me? I stayed myself.
You which, sorry?
I stay to myself.
Right. Okay. The one thing that I did want to ask about, and again, you said you didn't hang out with them, but one of the things that's always been interesting to me is hearing about the rivalry between Bruce Dickinson of Maiden and Sharon Osbourne. Do you know anything about this or where? Apparently they hate each other, but there's not much information on where this originated from.
I have no idea. No idea.
Fair enough. Okay. Look, you're around at, you know, around the scene. As much as we're probably both fans of it, I think it's fairly apparent to see that, you know, heavy metal reached its apex a long time ago, and it's now, you know, later on into the late 90s, it was dominated by rap music, and now it's been overtaken by, I guess, what they would call urban music. I'll ask you about some of the other scenes that came out of heavy metal, but do you think there will ever be sort of a revival of the music, or did it have its sort of period in time the way that disco did?
Metal?
Yes.
Metal has the loyalest fans in the world.
You're not wrong.
They'll be with metal for 30, 40 years. I don't see anybody jumping off the metal bandwagon. It's the best music in the world. Why would anybody ever want to leave it?
Well, you're not wrong about that, but it doesn't seem like we have the same amount of heavy bands, you know, selling out the same sort of stadiums as you would have expected in across the 80s.
Yeah. Well, all I could say is these bands stayed true to themselves. They did what they had to do, and they grew their audiences, and now everything is fantastic. God bless them all. I have to say this to you. I know you don't want to hear this, but we have to end this very soon.
No problem. Look, we can end it there if you have to run. That's fine. I just appreciate having the time to speak with you and talk about this.
This is a good interview, Jess, and I'm really sad to break it up, but I have to really get a few things done because I'm leaving tomorrow for my book signings in New York, and I have to get all my signed books out, and there's an awful lot of them, and the post office opens up for me at 8 o'clock in the morning just for me for an hour.
No problem, John. Well, look, I appreciate your time, and look, just to give you another plug, you know, that this is going to go out next week whenever everyone hears it. So John Zazula's autobiography is Heavy Tales, the Metal, the Music, the Madness as Lived by John Zazula. Now, for anyone else, we tried to organize this a number of times. John's speaking to us. When we originally got on the phone, it was it 6 in the morning over there in Orlando?
For me.
Well, it's about 10:30 at night, so I'll have another bourbon and we'll get on with it. But look, John, I appreciate your time. We've had the chance to speak with a few metal personalities, and I certainly appreciate your time.
Hey, listen, I wish I could have given you more time, Jess. This was a really nice interview. It's just that I just got to deal with the clock all the time. It really drives me crazy.
Hey, look, it's idle hands. It's better to be half to be busy, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, that's why I stay busy. As I said, it keeps me out of trouble.
All right, perfect. Well, John, thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, thank you, Jess. Have a